Hey guys, it's Emily. Welcome back to the Metabone Podcast. Today I have one of my favorite people, Mike McCarg, aka Science Mike. And let me just tell you, this guy is like a walking encyclopedia for all things science. He's a best-selling author and the host of Ask Science Mike. He's a public educator and a science advisor, which means this is the guy who worked with Marvel on Doctor Strange to make sure their story is scientifically accurate. We talked about the current outbreak of COVID-19, we talked about codependency and his autism diagnosis, and I just asked him a ton of questions about science and who we are and how we work. So here it is. Enjoy my conversation with Science Mike.
Well, hey.
Hey,
let's just keep talking about coronavirus.
It's the thing in the air, literally.
You want to share what you were telling me earlier?
Yeah, I mean, for people like us who work in events and work in entertainment, there's not like, when will this recession happen? It just did overnight.
Yeah.
I've seen all my events, except for one, which I'm expecting a call any minute, for the rest of the year, cancel. We're trying to figure out how to make my book tour happen, like in a way that meets people where they're at, which is kind of self-quarantined in their homes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a big deal. This is a pretty scary time. I want to say, first of all, that I think all the measures people are taking are good and necessary and right. We should not be gathering in groups of more than 100 right now.
Mm-hmm.
We should not be getting within 3 to 5 feet of other people we don't know at any point, if possible. So that is going to require some restructuring. But to avoid, and let's be real, like, I'm going to be okay. Like, the bad scenario for me is me and my wife and my children go back to Florida and live with my mom. Like, we'll have a roof over our heads. For other people, that's not necessarily true. And so the economic contraction that can come with a pandemic like this is going to hit vulnerable people the hardest.
Mm.
And so we've got to start thinking creatively and thinking immediately about ways to continue to have an economy that isn't so dependent on face-to-face interaction. I think about hourly workers in retail.
Yeah.
I think about restaurant employees. I think about the people who are going to be hit really hard very soon. Of course, we're going to need coordinated governmental actions. Yes, of course we're going to need that. And we as people are going to have to work together to try to keep everyone okay.
Yeah. Wow. What's your thought about schools closing? Because I've heard some different opinions about like whether or not that's a good thing, because some people are saying if schools close, then like nurses and people who work in hospitals then have to stay home with their kids. Have you done any research on that?
In a lot of these edge cases, there's no right answers.
Yeah.
There's only which set of outcomes you want.
Yeah.
So the whole goal here, what you'll hear experts talk about with COVID-19 is trying to flatten the curve.
Yeah.
So what we know is most people are going to get COVID-19. That's already settled.
Mm-hmm.
As much as 80% of people are going to get this virus, for sure. It doesn't matter what action you take, you're going to get it. What is not set is the amount of people who die from that.
Mm.
What we want to avoid is overwhelming our healthcare system.
Mm.
And if too many people get the virus too quickly and there's too many cases, then all hospital beds are full, healthcare workers work themselves to exhaustion and then sickness, and then people start dying, not only from COVID-19, but other medical conditions where they need care and can't get it.
Mm.
So the goal with all these closures is to slow the spread of the virus so we keep the total number of cases at any one point below the maximum capacity of the healthcare system.
Mm.
So schools play a big part in that. Kids are a major vector of illness. If you close schools, you will slow the spread of the virus. You will also put economically disadvantaged children who rely on schools for meals in dire straits.
Mm.
And many of our healthcare workers who rely on school for childcare effectively won't have that option available. It means if we close schools, we also need to figure out immediately and rapidly, now's not the time to think about government deficits, about how to provide for childcare needs and how to prepare for the basic nutritional needs of at-risk children.
Wow.
So those are there is no, like, this is the right thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you don't close the schools, this virus is going to spread very quickly. If you close the schools, it can impact marginalized people and healthcare workers.
Mm-hmm.
And that's experts like those times 1,000 are all the issues that policymakers and elected officials are facing right now while we're recording this episode. Because I've been trying to get people's attention for a couple of weeks that we were not acting enough based on my understanding of epidemiology. But I think I saw last night kind of everybody go.
Yeah, everybody.
Oh, this is a thing that's here.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a thing that is happening. And so I think there's a period of grief right now. And after that, we need to grieve. We're people. We have feelings, and our feelings are important.
Yeah.
But after a period of this initial grief, we've all got to start organizing towards collective action to make sure everybody's okay.
What's some of those actions?
Well, first of all, it's taking personal responsibility for the ways that you can receive and transmit the virus.
Yeah.
I'm going to be honest. I'm a guy, and whenever I use the restroom, I'm shocked and appalled how many men don't wash their hands after they use the restroom facilities. Yeah, I'm putting that secret out there, man.
Exposed.
I will be calling people out, strangers, if I'm in a restroom and they walk out and don't wash their hands. I'm going to public shaming on this.
Yeah.
Washing your hands. Now, you've heard probably the virus is airborne, and it is.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll talk about how to mitigate that in a second, but it does start with personal hygiene. What we know about SARS-CoV-2, which is the virus that causes COVID-19, is it's pretty stable on surfaces. Depending on conditions, it can live on a surface up to 9 days. So what happens if it's on a surface, we touch the surface, and then we touch our eyes, nose, or mouth, there's mucous membranes there, and the virus enters our bodies. So that's why hand washing really helps. 20 seconds of hand washing, like this.
Feels like an eternity. For those who are listening and not watching, he's demonstrating a really elaborate
set of hand washing routines. Every time I can, I try to demonstrate it for people. You do that for 20 seconds with your hands covered in soap, rinse, then you take a paper towel, you dry your hands, and use that paper towel to turn off the tap. Of course, you can use disinfectants to disinfect. And this is a case where paper towels are better for us than washing normal towels. Disinfecting surfaces helps a lot, too. And so those two measures will help you keep your hands clean, keep from getting the virus, and keep you from touching something else, and spreading the virus in a contact scenario. The other tool at our disposal is social distancing.
Mm-hmm.
This is not gathering in large groups of people, not being close. It's around time that we need to suspend hugs and handshakes.
Mm-hmm.
One expert I've seen say that people should do the Vulcan greeting, just a nice little live long and prosper when you see somebody. And you know, concerts, clubs, pubs, these are not things that we should be doing right now.
Mm-hmm.
And it means we're going to have to reinvest in online communities, smaller gatherings. It's okay to go over to a friend's house, just everybody kind of sits apart. It's weird, I know, it's totally counter to the way a social species works. But based on the way this disease works, if everyone doesn't do this, the people vulnerable to risk of death, which are older people and people with heart disease, pulmonary conditions, hypertension, diabetes, obesity, and anything that makes them immunocompromised, they have a serious risk of death from this, and everyone has those people in their life. And so even if you're young and healthy and in a low-risk group, you should still take all these precautions. But what you shouldn't do is panic and hoard.
Mm-hmm.
So what I've noticed is first we started people saying it's no big deal, it's not as bad as the flu, la, 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 this is not happening. And then when they accept that it's happening, they go to the grocery store and they buy all the bottled water and all the toilet paper they can buy. And these are not moves that are going to help you weather this virus. If you stock up on anything, don't hoard, but like acetaminophen, cough suppressant, Advil, hand sanitizer, Clorox wipes. These are good to have extra on hand. And then in terms of your food, just buy as if you're going to skip one trip to the grocery store each time you go. And that keeps us from like decimating our supply chains. And finally, and most importantly, don't buy masks, everybody.
Mm-hmm.
They don't help you. They won't stop you from getting COVID-19. all you're doing is taking the supply of masks away from hospitals who do need it, because the people who need to wear masks are people who are sick.
Mm.
And masks help reduce the spread when sick people wear them,
mm-hmm.
but not when healthy people wear them.
Mm-hmm.
So I've noticing kind of in the way our brains work, our panic response is leading us to take actions that maybe feel good, but ultimately not only undermine our individual health, but undermine our system's ability to respond to the threat of this virus.
Yeah, and that seems to be the bigger concern of like what we can control and take action for, that people in general just tend to neglect, is the more systemic things, because everybody starts thinking
every man
for himself,
yeah.
and like, what do I need? And not thinking like, oh, we need, like, it's going to affect me and everyone if we don't deal
mm-hmm.
with this in a way that allows the systems to take care
mm-hmm.
of it. So, well, thank you for that. That's helpful information. I mean, I've heard so much varying stuff, so it's good to get the good
I don't facts. YouTube a lot, but I put together a YouTube video last night that
mm-hmm.
describes all of the epidemiology, the risks, and the actions you should take,
okay, cool.
including a demonstration of that hand washing.
Perfect.
So
I'll link it in the bio,
yeah.
in the little description. Whew. Okay, well, now that we started on a really light note, and
the happy thing.
We can just play some games, and because what else are we going
to
do here?
It's what we need to do.
Wait.
Life's got to go
yeah,
on.
It's
yeah.
true. Yeah. Man, it's like, yeah, it does these kinds of things. If you look at them in the right way, any threat of death can be a really beautiful reminder to just be in the moment and not sweat the small stuff and just take everything in, because a lot of times we do kind of just exist not thinking about those things. And so I found for myself, just thinking about, whoa, like what could happen, it's gotten me to be even more present, even more like loving and attentive, and really thinking about every day what I'm doing. Because not only there's the threat of death, but there's the threat of like losing our jobs, losing our whole life changing. And so sometimes when stuff gets shaken up, that can be a good way to like bring us into what matters. So
yeah,
that's the good side of it. All right. Well, the other thing I want to talk about before we dive into this game is you have a book coming out.
I do. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you want to tell us a little bit about what the book
sure.
is about and when it's coming and all that stuff?
It'll be out April 28th. It's called You're a Miracle and a Pain in the Ass. And it's about two things. One, our value, our struggle to learn and accept our own value as people.
Mm-hmm.
And two, why we so often frustrate ourselves in what we do, think, and feel.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a look at all the different parts of your brain and your body that emerge to create you, and why they don't always get along, and what we can do about that.
Mm-hmm. I love that. I loved your book.
Thank
I read it.
You
sent me an early version of it, and I learned a ton about myself, and I feel like you did such a good job. What I love about the book is you merge like neuroscience and understanding just the logistics of what's happening in our brain in a way that really made me understand like, oh, this me, this I that I'm identifying with is a lot of systems, a lot of different things going on. And I think a lot of times when we are just thinking, oh, I'm just this person, we get confused and frustrated of why we have these seemingly contradictory experiences. And so I feel like that was really amazing for me to read and understand what all is going on within this me that I exist in. And then also looking into some of the more psychology aspects. You talk about attachment behavior, and you talk about emotions and like all kinds of stuff in your personal experience, learning a lot of that, like in what that did for you, discovering different things about yourself and your journey. So it's a beautiful read.
Thank you.
Really enjoyed it. Definitely recommend it. We'll get more into it as we pull these questions, because
okay.
there a lot of them have to do with
I'm
book.
So impressed with this whole thing.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I get into this kind of stuff, like making little crafty things. So we have these cards. What you're going to do is you're going to roll the die, and I'm going to pull one of these cards. I'm going to ask you a question,
okay.
and we're going to do that. Got some games and different things in here. Oh, these, you have to separate these into his and mine. I forgot to ask you to do that. Okay, so five is a story.
Okay.
So I'm going to give you a prompt, and you're going to tell me a little story
okay,
about the
I'll
prompt.
Try.
Okay, rock bottom.
Oh.
We're going straight in.
Which one?
Whatever you feel like sharing.
I used to work in corporate America in marketing and advertising.
Mm-hmm.
And I am particularly good at certain types of data-driven analysis. It's kind of like what I'm best at.
Mm-hmm.
And my skill at that led people to, you know, kind of experience me as being more broadly skilled than I am. And so I got like promoted at my job, which was like this rocket career arc. And I could not handle it. I couldn't hack it. I couldn't handle the pressure. I'm not particularly good at organizing people together to work together. And I was in a management capacity, which is a huge part of your job. And so I like lost it at work. We were in a meeting and all this like fear and anxiety and pressure I had felt kind of bubbled up at once. And I like threw all my things on the ground and threw things off of this conference table and quit and stormed out. And there was like this reckoning, because up until that moment, like I believed I had all these talents that I didn't. And so like the grief that followed that of realizing like, no, I just have like a really narrow set of skills, and then I'm pretty incompetent at not some things, but most things. That was tough, because you know, I'm a person that struggles with a sense of value and worth to begin with.
Yeah.
And so anytime I lose one of these little kind of handholds on identity, it's hard for me.
Yeah, I mean, that's a collective human experience. One of my favorite books of all time is A New Earth by Eckhart Tolle, and he talks about that. Have you read that book?
I've read a lot of Eckhart Tolle.
Yeah, that's one of his. And that's like a big premise in it, is how painful that is when something we're identified with and believe is who we are is lost in any form. That is the core, the root of suffering. Like, what makes us have that pain? Dang, well, I'm sorry that happened to you, but I'm glad that it made you who you are today.
Yeah, it's all part of it.
Yeah.
I'm learning to fail. That's kind of the season I'm in right now.
It's a good lesson. All right, give it another roll.
I love how bouncy the dice is on this table.
It is very bouncy. 4. Wow, I just realized these are swapped. And that's probably been irritating you for a while.
Didn't even notice.
Really?
I'm so enthralled with like the bespoke handmade cards.
Yes. Okay, so this is a game called the Game of Facts.
Okay.
I'm excited for this one. So I'm going to rattle off some words, and you're going to throw me a fact on the word.
Okay.
So, all right. Psychedelics.
Psychedelics are one of those promising mental health interventions we know of.
The neocortex.
Has over half of the brain's neurons.
The nervous system.
Goes beyond the brain and into the body.
Relationships.
Form the basis for how we see ourselves and how we feel.
Language.
Language is a technology that allows brains to teleport thoughts to each other.
Oh, I love that. That's the best definition. Desire.
How evolution taught us to survive.
I love that one too. Body.
Me. That's who we are. We're bodies.
Anxiety.
Anxiety is our nervous system's way of telling us that we need to pay attention to something.
Love that. Emotions.
The original and most ancient form of animal intelligence.
Love it. I pulled a lot of those from your book. I'm sure you can tell. Oh, I was like, what things are related to his book?
Oh, I thought those were standard that you asked everybody.
No. I just pulled a random assortment of topics from your book. No, those are my questions.
Amazing.
For sure.
So fun.
All right, give it another roll. 5. Okay, this is another story.
Okay, let's go.
Breakthrough.
Breakthrough. First week of this year, I did a week of group intensive therapy.
Mm-hmm.
And it was awful.
Mm.
I mean, it was terrible.
Mm.
I couldn't believe how unpleasant it was. Beyond unpleasant, terrifying. I was like, this can't be good for me. This is like re-traumatizing me. My therapist who was leading our group said, I need you to trust me that this is all going somewhere and that trauma hurts as it leaves your body.
Mm.
And I was like, okay, whatever. But actually, this therapist is pretty awesome.
Mm.
I liked her a lot, so I did just continue to go along with the process. And we did this. It was all built around things called psychodramas, or you might have heard called sculpts, just a full week of that and nothing else.
Mm.
And
you had a bad experience with one of those before at one of your men's retreats.
Yeah, that's how I figured out I have PTSD was a sculpt, mm-hmm. right. So that's a real loaded thing. But we did my like big work sculpt. I went last because I was so afraid. And major insights there, but it wasn't the insights that matter. It was the like embodiment that came from going that far into my feelings.
Hmm.
What I have found since then is I like my reflection. I've been able to tolerate my reflection, but I like my voice. You know what I mean? Like, there's things about me I like, but if you took the parts into a whole, I didn't like the whole of what I saw.
Mm.
And this year, even still with, like, some of the, like, really perpetual anxiety I have about the viability of my work as a business, not as impact, it has a lot of impact, but as a business, when I look in the mirror, I like me, and that feels like a real breakthrough.
That makes me so happy to hear. I like you. I like what I see.
Yeah, you know, it's so easy for me to like others.
Yeah.
But it has always been hard for me to like me.
Yeah.
And so that's new.
Yeah, I think a lot of people can probably relate to that.
Yeah.
Beautiful. All right.
Roll it again. Okay.
Yeah.
6.
6. Okay, is the top him or me? Oh, it's okay. We'll just do 2 and 2. So, this is a fun one. So, I talked to your wife, and
oh God,
she gave me some plans for this card, these two cards. So, there's 2 things written on this card. They may or may not be true about you.
Okay.
So, you're going to pull the first one, and you're going to read it to me convincingly whether or not it's true, and I have to ask you 3 questions to figure out if you're lying to me
okay.
or not.
Okay.
And then you will do the same to me.
As you know, I'm a skilled liar.
Yeah. What are your greatest features?
Mike attended space camp when he was in middle school.
Did you like space camp?
It was maybe my favorite thing I've ever done.
What was the coolest thing you learned at space camp?
I didn't realize that orbital velocity was the sole factor in determining orbital height and not vector.
Okay. And did you have a best friend at space camp?
Yes, his name was Chip.
That was pretty convincing. You're looking me straight in the eye, but I feel like you're doing that on purpose because you know about eyes and what they do. But also, I feel like you would have gone to space camp. I feel like it's true.
Do I reveal?
Yes.
It is false.
It's false. You did not go to space camp?
My like chest is pounding. I realized I blew it by making more eye contact than I usually do because I was so afraid. Here's why it was easy. I dreamed of going to space camp and had so many fantasies about it. I just pretended one of them was real. So I was like, well, this is going to be really easy because I'm going to miss all three questions. And then when I saw it was this, I was like, your fantasy space camp happened.
That was completely. Wait, what about the best friend? Is that a real person or you made him up?
Chip was my robot, imaginary android best friend when I was a kid.
Wow.
Who
I'm
in my
so
fantasy
impressed.
Was real and went to space camp with me.
Oh my God. That is so good. Oh, wow. Okay. I don't know if I'll do as well. So now you have to do the same for me. We'll see. On a recent trip to India, Emily had the opportunity to listen to the Dalai Lama speak.
Where did this happen?
This was in this like southern region of India called Karnataka, on a Tibetan reservation where a lot of refugees from Tibet have come to India so they can practice their religion freely.
What was the name of the venue?
It's a monastery called the Gaden Shartse Monastery.
Okay.
Brain calculating. The best way to trick me.
Did anything happen that surprised you?
Stefano got super sick with Deli Belly, and he didn't get to come. He had to miss it.
I think this story is true.
This is a true story. I tried to fake you with acting like I was making things up and looking away.
I caught that.
Dang it.
I caught that.
Dang it. I was like, should act like I'm thinking of something. No, that was true. That happened. It was like Monk Coachella. It was like thousands of monks packed in like a festival type stage where the Dalai Lama came out and spoke.
Your delay was perfect. The cadence and acuity of what you shared after the delay did not seem to be manufactured.
Dang it.
It seemed to be recollected.
All right, let's hear your other one. Okay, yeah.
Mike's Bacon number is 2, as in 2 degrees of separation from Kevin Bacon.
Wait.
On film.
Your Bacon number is 2 from actual Kevin Bacon.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so what's the degrees? Walk me through the separation. What's the connection?
Marshall Allman was in a film called Jane Mansfield's Car, with Kevin Bacon. And then I was in a film called Boo Like Jazz with Marshall Allman, giving me a Bacon number of 2.
Okay. Okay, that was pretty convincing. I'm not even sure what to ask as a follow-up question. When was the film?
I don't have any idea.
You don't remember when you did the film, Blue Like Jazz?
Not a clue.
I didn't know you were in a film of Blue Like Jazz, but I don't feel like you would have lied, made up that part. If you did, I'm very impressed. Because then I could look it up later. Dang. Okay, well, what's one thing that happened while shooting that film, Blue Like Jazz?
We shot in Nashville, and Don Miller wasn't even there because he wasn't in those scenes.
Mm.
So.
I feel like that's true.
It is very true. Yeah. My Bacon number is actually 2.
That's pretty
like
good.
Like, legit, because you have to... It's not who you know. You have to have been on screen.
Yeah, that's
so
pretty crazy.
So I'm in the same scene as Marshall Allman.
Jenny did good. Good job, Jenny. Those were good ones. Okay.
Those are good.
All right, this is my...
I'm actually really impressed with the space game one.
That was a great one. All right. My favorite food is taco truck tacos.
What taco truck has the best vegan taco?
The best vegan taco in Los Angeles is a taco truck in Silver Lake, not too far from here. It's called Tacos Zone. Yes, tacos with an S. It sounds funny.
Okay.
But it's actually probably called Taco Zone, but the sign awkwardly has an extra S in there. It's outside of the Vons parking lot.
Why are food truck tacos your favorite food?
Because they're affordable and they're fast and they're easy and they're not too unhealthy. They're pretty authentic still. It's not like fast food. Those are the reasons.
If suddenly food truck tacos were banned, what would be your favorite food in Los Angeles?
What's my second favorite food? Some sort of like bowl from like a place like Cafe Gratitude or something. That would be my second favorite food.
I think this is true.
This is true. It is.
Especially the time it took you to come up with your second, which I thought would reveal your first if you were being dishonest.
That was a good question. Good work. Good game. Wait, so I guessed wrong on one, and you guessed right on both mine, so you win. Congratulations.
Oh, gosh, I didn't think it was competitive.
It wasn't really. There's no prize.
Yeah, let's say. Just seemed fun.
Good roll again.
That's like just not a bad idea of something to do like I know, right? With friends over.
It is fun. It's a fun game.
Four. It's done.
That four is done. Yeah, reroll.
Three.
Three is a personal question.
Right on.
What is the most life-changing realization that you have had in the past year?
Gosh, this is a wild year to ask that question.
I know there's been a lot.
Life-changing realization. Life-changing realization in the last year. I am super codependent. And some of the things I like best about how I relate to other people are steeped in really unhealthy codependency. And so I've got to stop doing those things for a while until I can learn to do them in a way that is both healthy for me and the people I know.
What are some, for people who maybe don't know what codependency is, can you give us a little synopsis of what that looks like for you?
Oh, sure, yeah. Codependency is this pattern of behavior that we develop generally during childhood when we feel unsafe about our feelings or the feelings of someone else. And so I'm like a pro-level codependent rescuer, which means I kind of present as not really needing other people, which is a lie so convincing that I believe it. And then when I don't need other people, I can be there completely for them while needing nothing. And what I realize is I'm actually doing is this is called codependent rescuing. There's multiple presentations of codependency. But the reason I do that is to manage what people think and feel about me, right? So if I'm just always this rescuer hero, then people like me and accept me because I need nothing. I'm always there for them. The dark side of that silver cloud, the dark lining of the white cloud, I guess, gray lining, opposite of a silver lining, is when I'm doing that, I'm engaging in a nearly consistent pattern of controlling and manipulating people through indirect and dishonest means. And emotionally exhausting myself constantly. So because I take ownership for other people's feelings and not ownership for my own. My own feelings are something I blame on someone else. So that is not an adaptive pattern of psychological being.
Yeah.
And I don't feel shame over it. It's not something I was like, I'm going to teach myself to be codependent. But now that I know about it, it's my responsibility to teach myself not to be as codependent.
Yeah, that's all I can do. And that's why like awareness is the most important first step, because we all have been programmed and conditioned in certain ways. Once we become aware, then it's our choice. We have the agency to make different choices. So proud of you.
It's weird to be a guest on your podcast.
Why?
Because I'd just rather hear you talk about stuff.
I want to hear you talk about stuff. So it's great. Well, we can just keep doing this back and forth. All right. Let's give it another roll.
One.
This is an existential question.
It's probably my favorites.
Why do we hurt each other?
We evolved in a very challenging environment regarding resources. Cooperation is newer as a survival strategy than domination. And as animals evolved, especially mammals, especially primates, we have both of these competing drives. And all our brain body systems care about is surviving and reproducing. That's what DNA wants to do. Well, underneath all our wonderful personalities and hopes and dreams, we have bodies that are like, I really need to make more bodies. This is the important work. And parts of our brain body systems don't understand agriculture and finance and the fact that right now, structurally, we can feed every person on the planet, and yet we don't. And the reason we don't is because our reptile brains are not equipped to understand plenty. And we intrinsically believe at a fundamental biological level that plenty is a temporary luxury. And we hurt each other because our brains are constantly trying to navigate when to be cooperative and collaborative and social versus dominate and win. And we don't have a lot of control often about which state we're in.
Whoa. That got me just where an existential question should get me, which is like questioning my entire reality. Wow. So what do we do about that?
We recognize that human beings are animals. We have this weird thing where we look at the rest of the animal kingdom and we're like, of course dogs do what dogs do. But then we're like, God, people get it together.
Yeah.
We have to train ourselves in the same way we would train a cat or a dog or a horse or whatever. We have to understand that the most of our brain body system shares its anatomical features in common with other mammals. There's this little tortilla wrapped around our brain that is kind of the thinking part of the brain. And it's really good at deluding itself into believing it's in control all the time. But it's not. Our emotional instinctual systems are running the show all the time. And so the process of training and cultivating and honoring and caring for our emotional selves is the way we invite our brain-body systems into a more consistent pattern of collaboration and support.
It's not nuts that we can train ourselves?
It like, is quite what? Nuts.
That is crazy. It's amazing. All right, let's go to another roll. See what else we got. We still
two.
I was just going to say, we haven't done a two. This is an expert question within your expertise.
Okay. No pressure.
All right. Can you talk about what science actually is, what are its limitations, and how do we navigate balancing it with our own intuition?
Fantastic question.
Oh, thank you.
First thing I'll say is science is not a worldview. People tend to think science is a worldview, and it is not. Science is a methodology for uncovering information about the world and then ascribing a confidence level to that information. The way science does that is two and only two ways. Number one is by experiment, and number two is by observation. This is important because people tend to think science can only learn things from experiment, and that's not true. Science also learns from observation, where we record data and then analyze that data. So basically, the entire process of science is coming up with an idea, a hypothesis, that you bring out of some organized system of knowledge, and then designing a way to test that idea rigorously through either observation or experiment. And then based on the outcome of your work, when you do analysis on the data your observation or experiment produces, you can then ascribe a degree of confidence to your hypothesis as confirmed or not. It means it is completely impossible to prove anything in science ever.
Mm-hmm.
Only math can prove things. Science simply adds or reduces confidence in an idea.
Mm-hmm.
Other limitations of science is that science can't weigh in on matters of beauty. Science can't weigh in on moral issues, although it can inform a moral philosophy. It is not one. It can't tell us whether we should use the ability to split the atom to create bombs or power plants, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Science can't tell you what to do with the insight science produces. So it's got several pretty... Oh, and it can't weigh in on matters of the supernatural, as by definition, the supernatural doesn't leave a trace in the physical world. So those are some pretty big limitations.
Mm-hmm.
I think science and our intuitive minds make excellent partners. They produce a check and balance on each other. Our intuitive brains are prone to pretty severe flights of fancy, and that can lead us to bad places. Our intuition fuels the anti-vax movement.
Mm.
Our intuition is why, with COVID-19, people are buying toilet paper of all things, right? This is our intuitive minds in a panic state. But at their best, it's our intuitive brain that notices when another person is hurting. It's our intuitive brain that will experience some kind of intrinsic revulsion to a revelation in science, like the ability to split the atom. And without that intuitive information, science can be used in really brutal, dehumanizing, world-threatening things. Mm-hmm. You know, like science is telling us. Science both tells us how to build an industrial economy and tells us that it's destroying the climate. Mm-hmm. It is then up to other ways of thinking, including our emotional intuition, to tell us what to do with that scientific insight.
Mm. So we need to see them as partners and not adversaries.
I believe so, yeah.
Yeah, love that. All right, let's take another roll.
Take another roll of the dice. 4.
Don't have that.
Gonna roll a lot of 4s. 6.
Don't have them.
2.
Another expert question. I like these ones. All right, in your book, you talk about inhibiting emotions. Can you tell us a little bit about what those are?
Yeah, so we have our basic emotions, which if you've seen Inside Out will be very familiar.
Mm-hmm.
They're happiness, sadness, anger, disgust, sexual arousal, surprise, I think. And all those are really important feelings that help us make decisions. And at some point during childhood, we get messages that those feelings, some or all of them, aren't okay. So if you're a child and you express anger and a caregiver is angry back and scares you or withdraws and makes you feel lonely, then you get this message that anger's not okay. What that leads to is you need to get rid of that feeling to have social belonging. And as humans, social belonging is kind of like our major core drive. And we use an inhibiting affect to stop our feelings. Those are typically seen as anxiety, guilt, worry, and shame. Those aren't good feelings at all, but those are feelings that help us push down the feeling that we're not allowed to have. So often, when we feel anxious, what's really happening is we have another feeling that wants to express itself, that our nervous systems have been trained is not an okay feeling to express. And so it hides behind a cloud of anxiety that just persists and sticks with us.
Mm. That is like my favorite part of your book. And it has been game changing for me. And I talk about it all the time on my platforms. And I like think about it all the time. And it's so good.
I learned that information from Hillary McBride, who learned it from a psychologist who created a system of psychology known as AEDP, Accelerated Experiential Dynamic Psychotherapy. Her name is Diana Fosha, I think I said. Hopefully.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Awesome. Love it.
I like to give credit where credit's due.
Yes, it's important.
Two, another expert question.
All right. It's good. These are great ones. It's a good one. What is epistemology and how can we use it to discern truth?
Oh, man. That's halfway between existential and expert.
Yeah.
Epistemology is the study of how we know things. It's the idea of how knowledge is justified. Now, that's a big word and a confusing idea. Many scientists have an epistemology known as materialism. And in materialism, the way you know things is you have physical evidence for them. But that's not like a common epistemology in our society. Evidentialism and materialism, are underdogs. In the academy, rationalism is more common. We know things by making a chain of reasoned arguments starting from some fundamental truth. And then, there's other epistemologies. Some people have religious epistemologies where truth is derived from divine revelation or analysis of a sacred text. None of these things are good or bad. What I like to remember about epistemologies is they are survival systems that brains use.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, I tended to be pretty epistemologically flexible.
Mm-hmm.
I'm actually really comfortable leaning into a more mystical epistemology in my personal spirituality. But I don't bring that epistemology to how I look at the effectiveness of a given medical treatment in a disorder. Mm-hmm. At that case, I take that epistemological hat off and I put on a more evidentialist or materialist framework. When examining social issues, I might temporarily be a rationalist. I think from a neuroscience-driven perspective, and philosophers hate it when I do this, I'm not sure there's any such thing as a human being with a consistent epistemology anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So I just treat them like the problem-solving tools they are.
Yeah. Love it.
Yeah.
That's like one of my favorite literatist podcasts that you guys did was the epistemology one. I was like, which? Yeah, that's a great one.
If that was one of my favorites of all time.
To that. Three, personal. What is your current self-work?
Separating my worth from my work.
Mm.
I think right now, for the first time in my life, I am facing actual complete professional failure. Mm. I've never done it.
Mm.
I've never actually wiped out. It looks like that's the track I'm on right now. And, we're about out of money. I love living in LA. It's not looking good that we're going to be able to like work it out and stay here. There's a plausible path in the coming weeks where I move back to a hometown that I left, try to find some work and live with my mom.
Mm.
And, that's really scary to face and really scary to feel.
Mm.
And what my body wants to tell me is that because I can't turn my public impact into income and because I can't take care of my family financially, that I don't have worth.
Mm.
And so this work I've been doing for a long time around worth and belonging, our current socioeconomic climate is kind of forcing that lesson on me.
Mm-hmm.
And so my work will be to accept and love myself as all of the external or extrinsic ways that I create a self-image fall away.
Yeah.
So I'll have to see. My self-work is, who am I when I'm not Science Mike, when I'm not a corporate VP, and when I'm not the guy who pays the bills for my wife and kids?
Mm.
I have no idea, but I have a feeling I'm about to find out.
I think a lot of people are probably about to learn that lesson. You're not alone.
I think so.
It's So thanks for being vulnerable and sharing that, because a lot of people probably relate. A lot of people probably relate to that.
Yeah.
Oh, Corona. Okay, let's roll again.
Three.
Personal.
I like rolling these just the same numbers over and over.
That's fun. Can you tell us about your experience being diagnosed with autism and your journey since?
Yeah. Jenny has been saying for years that she thought I was on the autism spectrum. And I would be like, Jenny, you can't say that. That's really offensive to people with autism. And she's like, whatever, I'm just saying. And then people with autism would stand up at events and ask how I, as an autistic person, coped so well. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, that is so kind. I don't know what I've said to lead you to believe that I have autism, but I don't. So I would not speak into your experience. I can't imagine what it's like. And then people started sending me like cards and letters asking the same. Okay. And I still like disregarded all of it. And then my friend Hillary, who's like a PhD mental health expert, she's like, I don't know how to say this. I'm not your therapist. You're not my client. But have you ever thought you might be on the autism spectrum? I was like, geez, why does everybody keep saying this?
Mm-hmm.
So I took like a bunch of online screening tests, and they're all like, you should get tested for autism. So I went to a testing center and like waited for it to open. I didn't make an appointment because I get like focused. And walked in, and it was for kids, and they didn't treat adults. But like one of the therapists in the back recognized my voice and listened to the Liturgist podcast.
Oh, wow.
I guess she's not a therapist. She's a, anyway, subtle distinction. Psychologist is not a therapist. So she takes me to the back and like gives me some actual clinical screening tests.
Sorry, I think we just lost audio maybe. Oh no. It just sounded like it went out in my ear. Anyways, continue. I think it's still going. Are you good? Continue.
Okay. So she's like, yeah, your initial scores are certainly worth looking at. We don't test adults here, but I can get you in touch with someone who does. So I got in touch with that person and went through the whole process, and they like dig really deep into your childhood and school records and all these interviews, all these tests, and they're like, yeah, you have autism spectrum disorder. And it's actually been good for me to know that. One, it's helped me understand, like, some of the ways I struggle. Like, I present as really competent and capable.
Mm-hmm.
But every time I've ever been successful, it's because there's, like, a small army of people helping me do, like, daily living,
yeah,
which I don't excel at. And the things that I had the most shame and frustration about in my life that I hide from people are literally all symptoms of autism spectrum disorder. So knowing that there wasn't some, like, secret way that I was broken and messed up, that I'm just neurodiverse, has actually been really comforting. And the solidarity that I've experienced from people in the autism community learning about my diagnosis has also been really encouraging. Don't know how that happened. My phone's on Do Not Disturb. Yeah.
Wow. Well, thanks for sharing that. It's been beautiful to watch and witness your journey through realizing this about yourself and like just seeing it as a beautiful thing and embracing that as a part of who you are and like how so many of the things that I love about you and all your friends love about you is a lot of the things that come from your autism. So seeing it as something
wild,
unique and beautiful and awesome. It's been a really cool journey to experience.
Thank you, Emily.
All right. Well, my timer stopped going, and I think we're probably running out of time, so let's pull one more card, and then I have some rapid fires, and we'll wrap this thing up. It's a four. So many fours. Are you doing like a magic trick right now?
I'm trying to not do it.
It's like, is there like a magic trick that involves
it's not a magic
rolling
trick. You can practice throwing dice, which I have, and you can't do it 100% of the time, but you can do it a lot. Five.
That's a five. Okay, so we'll end with a story. changing your mind?
This is hard because I change my mind constantly. Like, constantly.
Yeah.
I used to be a religious fundamentalist.
Mm.
And I believed that the scriptures taught us that same-sex relationships were sinful and immoral.
Mm.
And it was always something like I had trouble like having emotional conviction about. I always felt like pretty guilty for believing that because I'd have like gay friends and I didn't care.
Yeah.
But I was like, but the Bible says I got to like, you know, be faithful to God. And I don't know. Like, I just kept seeing the outcomes of that. I kept seeing suicide rates. I kept seeing the caution that my LGBT friends had whenever they were around religious people. And a friend of mine told me about like growing up Baptist, how he like really loved the church, loved his faith, got married, wasn't able to be intimate with his wife, got divorced, came out, but like, you know, I'm going to fight this way, and how he was just like immediately shunned.
Mm.
And my faith was in the middle of falling apart anyway, separate story. But hearing his story is when I was like, I'm done with this way of thinking. And I think that was the first time in my life I'd changed my mind about something big.
Mm.
And that's why I share that story. One, because I want people to know deeply held beliefs like that really can change. But then, like, once you let go of one...
Yeah, then they all tumble
it's
down.
Pretty easy after that to change your mind about everything.
Well, you hit a certain point where you start realizing everything I think is just that. It's just a thought. It's
just something I learned.
Projection.
Yeah, just something like a lot of times I didn't even choose to learn it. I was trained.
Mm-hmm.
And that's led to this period where I kind of like more thoughtfully choose what I believe and avoid getting like some sense of, well, I'm superior and smart because of what I believe.
Yeah.
Because, like, I know how wrong I've been before. Mm. One of the most deeply held convictions I have now is that there's something big I'm wrong about today.
Yeah.
And I just like to be aware of that.
That's a beautiful way to think. Mm. I think the same way. And I think we have a resistance against that as mm-hmm. human beings to think that. And mm-hmm. it's good to train yourself to admit, I could be wrong about this. Like, this is a thought. This is a belief. This is coming from some kind of construct or conditioning or something I've been taught. And that is, at the end of the day, what is, and what exists is what exists. Mm-hmm. And what we think about it or say about it or judge about it is mm-hmm. just that. It's just a mental game. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. it's beautiful. All right, I'm going to ask you some rapid-fire questions, and then we'll peace out from this. Randy?
Yep.
What is love?
The most fundamental mammalian bonding system.
Mm. What's the best milk?
Oat milk.
Agreed. If an alien asked you right now to go to space, but you might not never come back, would you go?
If I can text Jenny, yes.
Spider in your house, would you kill it or set it free?
Leave it.
Oh, interesting.
They're predators. Like, I'd rather have spiders kill the bugs.
Sure. Current celebrity crush?
Chris Hemsworth.
That's good. What could you eat for a week straight?
Pizza.
Do you believe in past lives? I'm very curious to hear what you're going to say on this.
That's a tough rapid fire answer. I believe everything that made me now was around before me and will continue to be around after me, but I also think every femtosecond there's a new me.
Love that answer. Great. What happens when we die?
The same thing for everyone.
Mm. Where do ideas come from?
Neurogenesis based on environmental factors.
Mm. What's the biggest mistake humans have made?
Fossil fuels.
What's your ideal outside temperature?
Depends on the dew point.
Say something cool.
Can't wait for Half-Life Alyx.
What is the wind?
The atmosphere dealing with differences in temperature.
I just found our other game card got in there. Would you rather lose all of your hair or 50% of... Wait, would you rather lose all of your hair or gain 50% more hair?
Lose all of my hair.
What would you reincarnate as? If that were a thing.
A sloth.
Would you want to live forever?
No.
Cool. Cool. Love it.
That was the hardest one.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much. This was I have so much good stuff out of this conversation that I'm just so excited to share with everyone. As always, you just bring the good stuff.
Well,
I thank you for being here. And
it's my honor. I love to talk with you anytime I get the chance.
Thank you.
So if there's microphones, fine.
Amazing. I love it. So you have a podcast called Ask Science Mike.
Mm-hmm.
Where else? You have a book coming out. Tell us where we can find you, all the things people should know about.
The easiest way, because my name is so hard to spell. I just tell people to go to AskScienceMike.com,
mm-hmm.
and from there, everything is linked. So you can get to my main website, which is MikeMcHarg.com from there. But if you go to AskScienceMike.com, you're going to get all of me you'll ever want.
Amazing. So if you liked this, Ask Science Mike is basically this, asking Mike questions about
only
science.
Only you, the audience, are the ones asking
yes,
the questions.
Yeah. Yes, for sure. So, cool. Well, thank you.
Thank you, Emily.
Thank you guys so much for listening. Remember, you can always watch these interviews on the Metamoon YouTube channel. And if you ever have thoughts, suggestions, requests, anything, just reach out to me on social media at emily.capshaw. Until next time, remember you are safe, you are loved, and you have everything you need within you.